This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. On today's program, it may be nostalgia, but the moon landing anniversary is also inspiring a new generation to look to a future in the space industry. And parents aren't going to like this. Figures show a surge in the use of MDMA or ecstasy by high school students.
Next year, apparently, that's when everything happens, I guess. Older friends, they all do it.
Year 11.
Yeah, year 11, 12.
So why do you think they do it?
Just because it's fun, makes a party better.
A US Navy ship has destroyed an Iranian drone in the Strait of Hormuz in the latest incident to stir tensions in the Gulf. President Donald Trump has called on other countries to condemn Iran and protect their own ships after Iran declared late yesterday it had seized a Norwegian oil tanker in the Gulf. Our North America correspondent Zoe Daniel joined me a short time ago.
Well, the President, Sabra, says that the Iranian drone essentially got too close to the USS Boxer. He says that the drone was within 1,000 yards or around 900 metres from the US ship, which is carrying some 2,000 US Marines. It does have substantial capabilities. It can launch attack jets, for example, and helicopters from its landing deck. Donald Trump told reporters late today here in the US that this was the latest example of Iran threatening international shipping in that region, and for that reason, the drone was shot down. Let's take a listen.
This is the latest of many provocative and hostile actions by Iran against vessels operating in international waters. The United States reserves the right to defend our personnel, our facilities, and interests, and calls upon all nations to condemn Iran's attempts to disrupt freedom of navigation and global commerce. I also call on other nations to protect their ships as they go through the strait and to work with us in the future. Thank you very much. I thought you should know that.
That's the US President Donald Trump. And Zoe, what were they both doing there?
Well, this is the question, isn't it? Because the Strait of Hormuz is the region where tensions had previously occurred between Iran and the US. You'll remember that last month Iran shot down an American surveillance drone in a dispute over whether it was in fact in international waters or in Iranian territory. And that then sparked further tension between the two countries, with the US threatening to retaliate with military strikes against Iranian targets. And Donald Trump is said to have in fact ordered those strikes before pulling them back. So there's definitely a lot of tension in the region. What's happened though, Sabra, in the last few weeks since then is that Washington has accused Iran of sabotaging and stopping oil tankers and shipping in that region. And Iran is said to have stopped a Panamanian oil vessel with 12 crew on board. So it's suggested that the USS Boxer, this amphibious ship, was moving through the Strait of Hormuz into the Persian Gulf, perhaps because of that incident when this incident with the Iranian drone took place.
How will the shooting down of this drone affect tensions between the two countries?
Well, I think it's pretty obvious that it will just ratchet those tensions up again. And of course, they have been simmering. They had not gone away. As I said, there's been this continuing to and fro about Iran stopping and, as the US describes it, harassing vessels in that very key oil shipping lane. And the issue that we had a few weeks ago was also not gone away. And that is that the tension is so high that the capacity to have any sort of useful discussion or negotiation between the two countries is very minimal.
That's our North America correspondent, Zoe Daniel. And President Trump's declared he wasn't happy with controversial chants his supporters directed a Somali-born Democratic congresswoman. During a campaign rally yesterday, the commander-in-chief made a string of complaints about Ilhan Omar, one of the first two Muslim women elected to the nation's House of Representatives. It prompted the crowd to shout, "Send her back." North America correspondent James Glenday reports.
Send her back! Send her back! Send her back! Send her back! It was this ugly moment at an otherwise relatively run-of-the-mill Trump rally that infuriated the president's opponents and left his Republican allies scrambling to explain his intentions.
So he has no responsibility to turn to his supporters and say, that's not fair.
What he did in his responsibility was right. He moved on to make them stop in the process.
Ilhan Omar is one of a group of four outspoken left-wing congresswomen, nicknamed the Squad, who the president has recently accused of hating America. At the weekend, he told them to go back to their own countries, even though only Ms. Omar was born abroad. The crowd's chant yesterday, though, he says, went too far.
I was not happy with it. I disagree with it. But again, I didn't say that. They did.
Why didn't you stop them? Why didn't you ask them to stop saying that?
Well, number one, I think I did. I started speaking very quickly.
That claim does seem to be contradicted by video of the event. And Ms. Omar says, in any case, the president's rhetoric is entirely to blame for the language.
And as much as he's spewing his fascist ideology on stage, telling you as citizens to go back because they don't agree with his detrimental policies for our country, we tell people that here in the United States, dissent is patriotic.
Mr. Trump's recent attacks on the Squad seem a clear political calculation ahead of next year's presidential election, where he could face a moderate opponent like former Vice President Joe Biden, who was among the many to condemn the Commander-in-Chief.
It was despicable to stand and attack those four women.
In contrast to Mr. Biden, the Squad's ideas and policies are further to the left of the majority of the party, and the recent focus on the group by Republicans and the president is a pretty clear attempt to make the Democrats look more diverse and radical than they actually are.
Let us pray. We give you thanks.
In Congress, even Chaplain Patrick Conroy seemed to reference the fray in his prayer opening proceedings this morning.
This has been a difficult and contentious week in which darker spirits seem to have been at play in the people's house.
Despite hopes for a kinder debate, this controversy is likely just a taste of the election campaign to come. In Washington, this is James Glenday reporting for AM.
A lawyer for a Chinese-Australian detained in Beijing says it could be weeks before he's formally charged with national security offences. Sydney-based writer Huang Henjun has been detained for 6 months and he's been denied access to lawyers. He's now been moved from a state security prison to a criminal detention centre just ahead of a deadline for authorities to charge or release him. China correspondent Bill Birtles reports.
After half a year locked away in what's called a residential surveillance centre in southern Beijing, writer Yang Hengjun's move to a criminal detention centre nearby is an ominous step. His lawyer, Sheng Baojun, says it doesn't necessarily mean he will be charged, but it looks likely.
It's not certain they'll announce charges. The criminal detention order he's now under is still part of an ongoing national security investigation. After this detention is finished, which could be at least 2 weeks, then it will be up to the prosecutors to decide whether to charge him.
54-year-old Yang Hengjun once worked for China's government, either the Foreign Ministry or State Security. He later moved to Australia, started writing online and became a voice critical of China's government. But in more recent years, he's been seen as a moderate and even appeared at a state media function in Beijing. The lack of answers on what he's alleged to have done has baffled friends and family, and even his lawyer, Sheng Baojun, doesn't know.
Because he's accused of endangering national security, it's impossible for his family members to visit him. His lawyers can apply to meet him, but that's decided by the relevant authority.
So far, they haven't been permitted to see him. Only Australian diplomats, once a month, have visited him. But their meetings are closely monitored by state security officers who sit in and forbid questions specifically about the case. Australian diplomats have again requested Yang Hengjun be granted access to lawyers. But supporters like UTS academic Feng Chongyi believe it's time for the government to be more vocal about his case.
I think the government can at least directly challenge these evil laws which allow security apparatus to abuse Australian citizens, including torture and detention without access to lawyers.
Young Hung Jun's Chinese wife has been granted permanent residency in Australia, but for now, she's barred from leaving China. This is Bill Birtles in Beijing, reporting for AM.
And thank you for your company on AM this morning, where it's approaching 10 past 8. As a coronial inquest into the drug-related deaths of six young people closes today, experts are calling for more education about drugs at schools. They argue the current messaging focuses too much on alcohol and that it should be broader, pointing to figures showing a surge in high school students taking ecstasy. In recent years in particular, the use of the drug has doubled among 16 and 17-year-old boys. Gavin Coote reports.
Speeding around the local skate park in Sydney's leafy North Shore, these 15-year-olds have already taken their fair share of risks. And like many their age, these boys have now had the drug talk with their parents.
Yeah, well, they sort of didn't really talk to me until I got caught smoking.
Yeah, same.
But smoking tobacco?
Marijuana.
Same.
Yeah, it was me too.
They say they've been offered ecstasy, also known as MDMA, but have said no.
Next year, apparently. That's when everything happens, I guess. For more, like, older friends, they all do it. So.
Year 11?
Yeah, year 11, 12.
So why do you think they do it?
Just because it's fun, makes a party better.
These attitudes have worried experts who have been nervously watching drug use trends in recent years. Tobacco and alcohol use among secondary school-age children has actually dropped over the last 5 years. And cannabis is relatively stable, according to the National School Survey. But ecstasy use has doubled, with 1 in 20 students aged between 12 and 17 having used the drug at least once. And for boys aged 16 to 17, it's double that figure, with 10% having tried ecstasy. Stephen Bright, who's a senior lecturer in addiction at Edith Cowan University, doesn't see that trend letting up.
I think there'll be continue to be gradual increase unless we do something different.
Dr. Bright, who'll today be giving evidence at the New South Wales coronial inquest into drug-related deaths, says there's been a big education gap in the secondary schooling years, where he argues the messaging is too narrowly focused around alcohol.
The education departments in various states have been careful not to provide any harm reduction when it comes to drugs, because I think there's a concern that in doing so, they might be suggesting that it's okay for young people to use drugs. And I think it's important to distinguish that harm reduction just wants to give people pragmatic information on how they might reduce drug-related harm.
In New South Wales, the Teachers Union is calling for a specialist drug education unit, which was abolished in 2012, to be reinstated. The state's Department of Education says senior high school students take part in a compulsory 25-hour life-ready course and also have access to a school counsellor. Craig Peterson from the Secondary Principals Council cautions against placing further responsibility on the schooling system.
We are professional educators. We know how to teach. We know our curriculum content. We're not psychologists. We're not social workers, and we don't have expertise in some of these areas, and particularly in relation to substance abuse. Even in a large school, there will be one counsellor for the entire school population, and the workload's simply beyond them.
That's Craig Peterson from the New South Wales Secondary Principals Council, Gavin Coote reporting there. The United Nations says the methamphetamine market in the Asia Pacific is now the biggest in the world. According to a new report, the region has undergone a profound transformation linked to a huge jump in the manufacture of synthetic drugs. The retail meth market in Australasia alone is estimated to be worth more than $15 billion. Southeast Asia correspondent Catherine Diss reports.
The deadly scourge of methamphetamine use in Australia has been the target of drug campaigning by the government for years.
You stop sleeping, stop caring.
The drug, which has led to increases in violence and deaths, was a few years ago largely being manufactured on home soil. But Jeremy Douglas from the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime says a crackdown by authorities targeting clandestine drug laboratories and an influx of cheap methamphetamine from Southeast Asia has upended the market.
Where you see the surge out of Myanmar, you start seeing less and less production within a place like Australia as well. And then you start seeing this huge volume of methamphetamine coming into the country in larger shipments. So what that tells us is that the producers here in Asia have formed very strong relationships with organized crime in Australia.
The organization has been conducting a comprehensive investigation into transnational organized crime over the past 18 months. With Australian and US government funding, the team uncovered a global shift in methamphetamine production markets from China to Southeast Asia, which Jeremy Douglas estimates is now worth up to $85 billion, a fourfold increase since 2013.
You know, what we saw was a migration of production from certain parts of southern China into certain parts of northern Myanmar to avoid law enforcement capacity and law enforcement efforts there. So it really uprooted, moved these big drug labs or closed them down. They were closed down on them in China and then pushed production into Myanmar, where now we see super labs or industrial scale facilities running.
The most valuable markets, Australia, Japan, New Zealand and South Korea, make up a third of the trade. Just last month, Australian Federal Police intercepted the country's largest ever shipment of ice, hidden inside stereo speakers sent from Bangkok to Melbourne. Steve Allsop from the Drug and Alcohol Institute in Australia says the country's close proximity to Southeast Asia and its vast coastline makes it easy for traffickers to breach.
It still is manufactured within Australia, but what's happened is the importation from other countries has become a much larger proportion of the methamphetamine and ice in particular that's available in the country.
According to the UN report, more than 12 million users across Southeast Asia, Australia and New Zealand consumed more than 320 tonnes of pure methamphetamine last year, the bulk of it from industrial-scale factories in northern Myanmar. This is Catherine Deese reporting for AM.
The works of celebrated Australian artist Howard Arkley are in more demand than ever before. Just last month, a new record for his work was broken when his painting Deluxe Setting sold for $1.5 million. But experts are warning the market's become plagued by fake Arkleys. A background briefing investigation has uncovered the authenticity of three expensive Arkleys has been cast into serious doubt. It's found all three suspect works can be traced back to a single group of high-profile identities in Melbourne's art market. Hagar Cohen reports.
If you fancy decorating your lounge room with a bona fide Arkley, you better have deep pockets.
What a work!
The eccentric painter died of a heroin overdose in 1999. Since then, art dealer Andrew Crawford says the market had been plagued with suspect paintings supposedly by Arkley.
The problem is pretty significant.
Back in 1988, an Arkley painting called Family Home was sold by Tolano Galleries for $8,500. Fast forward nearly 20 years and Family Home set a record price for the artist when it attracted a bid of $407,000 at an auction by Joel Fine Arts. But there was just one problem.
This is not the picture that was sold by Tolano Galleries in 88.
The record-breaking painting looked similar to the original, but it was a totally different work. The background briefing program found that the receipt from the original sale in 1988 was used by an unknown seller to establish the authenticity of the second painting in 2007. The original buyer of Family Home was Melbourne art dealer Peter Gant. Mr. Gant once had a thriving trade in the Melbourne art world, but his dealership fell into decline as he became embroiled in a criminal court case over three paintings, which he said were by celebrity artist Brett Whiteley. A jury found him guilty, but he was acquitted on appeal. Nevertheless, many collectors who've bought paintings once owned by Mr. Gant or his close associates have sought advice on whether their prized possessions are the real deal.
It had a stigma, and it had a stigma because of where it come from.
Art investor Rick Anderson bought Pink House, another Arkley painting, for $200,000 at the prestigious English auction house Christie's.
One of the dealers, I took it to his gallery. Then he rang me up the very next day and said, you're going to have to get this picture out. And I said, well, why aren't you showing it to someone? He said, I can't, the picture's fake, mate.
Rick Anderson says Christie's, who've declined to comment for this story, had sold Pink House on consignment for a Melbourne dealer named John Playfoot. Mr. Playfoot had helped Peter Gann sell one of the dubious Whiteley paintings that later featured in the Supreme Court case. Rick Anderson was later offered a secret deal by Christie's.
They accepted that it was fake and they refunded the money.
The ABC has obtained a confidential report which raises serious questions about a third work titled Greek Style. Forensic experts from Melbourne University assessed the work and concluded,
"This painting cannot be placed into the oeuvre of Howard Arkley."
John Playfoot and Peter Gant have declined to comment.
Hagar Cohen reporting, and for more on Hagar's report, search for the latest Background Briefing episode in your favourite podcast app. Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister says he wants Australia to provide a timetable to end asylum seeker processing on Manus Island. James Morape will travel to Australia this weekend for his first official visit and says he'll raise the issue with Scott Morrison. It's 6 years today since Labor announced its agreement to resettle refugees in PNG. Here's our PNG correspondent, Natalie Whiting.
When Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Morape touches down in Australia this weekend for a six-day official visit, it will be a sign of the country's close relationship. But Mr. Morape says it will also be an opportunity to get to work.
So we will be exchanging pleasantries but getting down into business.
The Australian government has said it's looking to discuss boosting trade and investment and strengthening cooperation on labour mobility, defence and security. Mr. Morape also wants to discuss the processing of asylum seekers on Manus Island. It's 6 years to the day since then Prime Minister Kevin Rudd announced those who arrived by boat would be processed and resettled in PNG. And it seems PNG has had enough.
We'd like it to be ended as soon as possible.
Mr. Morape says he'd like to establish a timeline for finishing the program.
I've met Immigration Minister Peter Dutton already. I've asked him to expedite the process of phasing out issues of asylum seekers. We need to have established a timeline going forward. They're genuine refugees and they're also non-genuine refugees. What happens to the residual we have in countries?
In a joint statement issued last month, the two countries said they were committed to supporting individuals seeking to engage in existing settlement and resettlement opportunities. 50 refugees have opted to set up lives in PNG, while more than 500 refugees from PNG and Nauru have so far been resettled in the US.
But these are human beings we're dealing with. We can't leave them all hanging in space with no serious consideration to their future. So.
This is Natalie Whiting in Port Moresby for AM.
It's hard to miss this weekend's 50th anniversary of the moon landing. There's been plenty of nostalgia in recent days as people look at the scratchy footage. And if you haven't seen it, check out the ABC's digital story showing what happens to Neil Armstrong's heart rate as the Eagle lands. It's stunning. The anniversary is also prompting many to think about the future. In space camps across the US, high school students are contemplating their own trips into the space industry as America plots a return venture to the moon and also Mars. But unlike the 60s moonshot mission, these future NASA plans are reliant on a range of funding beyond the government. North America correspondent Connor Duffy reports from Wallops Island NASA base in Virginia.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
The astronauts of the future are taking off. 13-year-olds Kenner O'Brien and Lauren Allison are spending their summer at space camp designing rockets, their thirst for adventure and competitive spirits fired by the Apollo landing.
I mean, just being able to beat the Soviet Union there and just being able to say that we made it to the moon through trial and error. It took 11 tries, but we finally made it.
Today's aim is more modest. Fire a rocket 200 metres high. For Kenner and Lauren, it could be the start of a much steeper climb.
We're just hoping it'll go a lot higher than someone else. So, yeah.
You hear
so
that?
You're shooting for the stars?
Literally.
Yeah.
US President Donald Trump has been praised for revitalising America's ambitions in space. Brendan Curry is from the Planetary Society, which promotes space exploration. He's thrilled by renewed interest from the White House.
I started working in the space policy business 20 years ago, and if you talked about humans to Mars,
people on Capitol Hill would laugh. People aren't laughing anymore. They're taking it damn serious.
The administration's $20 billion in funding to power a return to the moon in 2024 and Mars 2 years later is a fraction, though, of what powered the Apollo launches.
In current year dollars, the Apollo program was roughly about $300 billion in toto. At the time, at its peak, it was about 4% of the entire U.S. federal budget. Right now, NASA is about 0.1%.
Australian entrepreneur Peter Bale works closely with the team at this NASA base in Virginia. His specialty is autonomous vehicles. He says the private sector will fill any funding black holes.
Absolutely. You've seen the resurgence of commercial launches, and now with NASA, with the larger programs under the administration of getting back to the moon and the Mars program, there's a real resurgence in our young folks here on interest again in the space industry.
Kenner and Lauren don't believe any planets are out of reach. They'll graduate school in 2024, 2 years before the start of the Mars mission.
Who knows? Maybe we'll have lightsabers someday. I just think that it's awesome how we could maybe all come together. It'd not just be an accomplishment for just America. It'd be for, the whole world in general, that we've made another step forward. Who knows? Maybe after Mars, we're going to Jupiter. I don't know.
This is Connor Duffy in Virginia for AM.
And as the world remembers the moon landing, some doubters still think it was fake. But Australian scientists at the ANU who've studied the rocks the astronauts brought back from the moon say the rocks prove the conspiracy theories are wrong. Australians were also responsible for sending visual proof of the moon landing back to the world. Felicity Ogilvie reports.
It's something that had to be seen to be believed. A man walking on the moon. And the pictures were made possible by the engineer at the CSIRO's Parkes Radio Telescope, David Cook.
I was in the control room because I had to watch the performance of the receiver.
The now 87-year-old had the task of managing the signal that sent out the historic TV proof to 650 million people around the world.
I was able to look this video monitor. There's nothing like video monitor today. It was not only black and white, it was green and white. and only quite small. It was quite amazing to watch this event take place. There's nothing like that had ever happened before.
The pictures of Neil Armstrong setting foot on the moon were sent from another dish in Australia, NASA's Honeysuckle Creek tracking station near Canberra. 86-year-old Mark Dinn was the deputy director there.
We didn't really know what to expect, and it came out with a fairly strong contrast between the brightness of the moon's surface and the darkness of the sky, for want of a better word, on the moon.
The idea that the moon landings were faked may have only been embraced on the fringe, but scientists felt it was worth disproving the conspiracy. 89-year-old retired Professor Bill Comston has held and studied the rocks.
Well, you had to use your glove, and you had to keep the sample in a safe when you're not actually working on it. But I did on the first couple of days. I took a sample home to show my family, so they could see it. They didn't put their paws on it, but because I was supervising it.
He says the moon rocks look like earthly basalt and conglomerate rocks. Professor Comston worked at the ANU and was chosen by NASA to study the moon rocks because he was a pioneer in a method of determining the age of rocks.
We found the rocks from the moon were 4.3 billion years old.
NASA has brought back 382 kilograms of rocks from their 6 Apollo missions to the moon. Scientists at the ANU still study the rocks. Professor Trevor Island specialises in lunar soil.
If we were to try and deceive the public by masquerading these rocks, we would get into all sorts of problems because we just simply cannot make a material that looks like a lunar rock that has the age characteristics of 4.35 billion years, has all the right trace element geochemistry and so forth. Plus, we would have had to known in advance what the moon was like.
Once the scientists finish studying the moon rocks and soil, they have to send them back to the NASA Johnson Space Center in Houston.
Felicity Ogilvie reporting. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Angela Voipierre.
And I'm Stephen Stockwell, and we're from the ABC's Daily News and Current Affairs podcast, The Signal.
50 years after the moon landing, there is a new race to get back there.
This time, there are a bunch of countries in the contest, plus the private sector.
So why is everyone suddenly so keen after decades of disinterest? And how soon could we live on the moon?
That's The Signal. Find us on the ABC Listen app or wherever else you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.